your signature.
What's this? Okay.
Well, call the meeting of the gas pipeline financing committee to order. I think everybody's been given a copy of the agenda, so unless there's nothing that has to come up before we get to the agenda, we'll start right off with an update from Jack Bachman, the ex officio member of the committee representing Northwest. Jack?
Well, as I said, Bill, we don't have very much new to report. It hadn't been very long since that meeting in San Francisco. The principal things I think to report are meetings that will start December the 5th with Alyeska on the acquisitions of Data and Camp, negotiations on final price and that sort of thing. The partners are meeting in Washington tomorrow and Wednesday. Northern Border will meet the following day, I understand. Those two meetings are going to be primarily 1979 budget meetings, so from my perspective, they could be kind of interesting. The variable rate of return from FERC is on FERC's calendar for Wednesday this week. And, I hope that will come out the way we want it to. Since San Francisco, and perhaps contrary to the impression that had been left at that meeting, I've talked to John McMillian about the Section 103 Internal Revenue Code exemption, and he is still optimistic and is assured that properly packaged that exemption can be acquired. It may be very narrowly packaged, an Arctic pipeline being built pursuant to ANGTA or something like that, but he thinks it can be done for the sale of $1 billion of bonds for this pipeline.
Can I ask who the assurances are from?
Don't ask.
Okay. I take that back.
One thing that has been of interest to me, and I hope perhaps we'll get into this a little bit today, the session here in Alaska starts in just a little over a month. And I don't know whether this is going to be this committee's intention to try and prepare a plan prior to that time for state participation or whether we wait until after the session's first early part of the session. I think the legislation requires some kind of report back. And what we can do, how we can help, perhaps we can get into that a little later.
I think the last meeting we kind of agreed that we couldn't have a positive recommendation one way or another. They're just the energy failure, the passage of the energy bill just backed everybody up, so we can't say yay or nay to the possibility by January.
And I think there's even further things that are perhaps going to entail some additional delays. The rate of return thing presumably will come down, and perhaps that will address the inflation change, which has not been addressed by FERC, the adjustment for inflation. Scope changes, federal inspector still not appointed. It's very difficult to project how things are going to go in the next few months.
When do you expect Jack FERC to come down with the decision on the incentive rate return?
It's on the calendar for Wednesday this week.
But do you expect an answer, a final solution this year?
Within some limits. I expect that there will be an answer as to what will be the range in which the final answer will be determined. But obviously the final order is not going to come until just before certification or maybe even part of the certificate. But I think it's going to be the guidelines are going to be laid out. Hope they are.
Well, Jack, if it isn't as favorable as you hope to be, do you think at that time you're going to determine whether or not you're going to ask for federal help?
That's a bridge I would hate to cross now and try to second guess what may happen. I think a lot would depend on just how unfavorable or what the prospects were. There are always appeal procedures within FERC, of course, and narrowed to a limited issue, we can perhaps take advantage of those too. I may be smarter on Thursday than I am today.
If it's not acceptable, or substantially not acceptable, as it appears to be right now, in light of the recent filings, there seem to be a number of problems in light of the recent filings back and forth. What about delay? Will there be a delay?
I think that there's. It appears right now that the delays are building up to a point where there will have to be a decision point within the next 30 days or so, whether there will be an additional delay. And of course, the delay in this pipeline doesn't mean lose a month here and tack a month on the end. A delay probably means another full working season. The processing plant, I see, is one of the big stumbling blocks on that, which would entail further delay.
Has there been any progress on the discussions?
To my knowledge, no.
Is there any discussion?
Positive discussions, I'm not aware of any, Bill. I know there's lots of fringe area people talking to each other, but anything really sitting down and discussing it hard-nosed, hard head-to-head, I don't know of any.
How about the gas sales contract? Any negotiation on that?
There will be further meetings on gas sales contract. Our sister company, Northwest Pipeline, has been back at ARCO, particularly trying to negotiate for their gas. Just how much else is going on, I don't know, and I haven't been in the office to ask.
Terry?
Okay, could you clarify for me a little as to how that actually might happen if the parent company is negotiating with ARCO to buy the gas? Then would there be an additional contract with other persons for the sale of that gas?
Oh, sure. No one buyer is going to buy all of the gas from any one producer or from all the producers. They will contract for what volumes they think they can use.
All right. Will Northwest be the middle person in terms of purchasing all the gas and then selling it to other parties?
No, that's not the way it works out. By the nature of this pipeline, it's a contract carrier pipeline. We, Northwest Alaskans, will not own the gas that flows through it. I've made that clear before. Neither will our sister company, Northwest Pipeline, who is a wholesaler, like there are many others in the lower 48. They'll buy what they think they can use, but they'll be dealing and negotiating for only the volumes they think they can use. We won't stand in the middle, nor will Northwest be wholesaling it to other pipeline purchasers. They'll each negotiate their own contracts.
Okay, so then somewhat it's up to the producers on the slope to initiate efforts to sell the gas with whoever wants to buy it, or for somebody that feels they need gas to come to the producers.
That's exactly right, and that's where we at Northwest Alaska have felt rather helpless, because we aren't buying the gas. We haven't been able to put much pressure on anybody except our sister company to get after it.
Well, is part of the problem why there's no activity on this because of the so-called short-term surplus in the U.S. markets?
Well, that probably has some effect, but frankly, the biggest reason for holding back was the lack of a price from the energy bill, which we got only just a few weeks ago.
Sam? Can I ask a question about the import provisions? This most recent newsletter from Northwest indicates that there's been a favorable approval for imports on the Pan Alberta 1.04 BCF. What happens if the Canadian National Energy Board doesn't give export approval to that same outfit? What if they give it to somebody else? How is that conflict going to be addressed?
Well, obviously, that could, if that were to come to pass, kill the whole thing. But the unique thing is that we have gas purchase contracts actually in existence to buy the gas. We are committed to buy the gas in Canada for which that export permit is being requested.
Once again, on that, now you've got...
We have firm contracts to purchase gas in Canada.
If the NEB allows...
If the NEB allows it, right. So far as I know, we're the only ones in that position. We're the only ones asking for an export permit.
Who's we?
So that, in this case, it's Northwest Alaska. But that the circumstances there are that if... What could happen, of course, is they just deny our export permit. They would not take it and give it to somebody else. Somebody else is going to have to make another application for the same or different volumes. But there's no competition here. We've got the contracts, the gas is committed, we're asking for the permit to take it out of Canada.
But you are competing with other exporters against at the NEB, aren't you?
Not for the export permit, no. The only thing we competed for, and nobody else was a very strong competition, was actually putting up the money to buy the gas, committing to buy it. We've got the volumes totally committed, sellers and purchasers.
Sam?
I guess I'll take care of it later.
Jack, I want to pursue an earlier comment there on the expectations of what this committee plans to do. I was left with a distinct impression when you queried this aspect a couple of meetings ago, and Fred, you responded, and it's my recollection that I cautioned you on the the hastiness of your reply if you wanted to reconsider it for a later time. Is the administration in any better position to come with a firm suggestion, or are they expecting us to make a provisional, opinion?
No, definitely not by the beginning of the session, and unless things accelerate much more rapidly than we anticipate they will, probably not at all during the session. I mean, we will have to spend quite a bit of our time, and I expect you'll have to spend your time looking at it, continuing to collect information, but I don't think we're going to be in a position to make a final recommendation and meet all of the standards set out in the bills, because we just don't have the data and probably won't have it.
Okay, which brings me back to Jack. Has there been a redirection or re-emphasis that now you're at a standstill until we make a decision? Because, we sort of put that to rest once. I thought that
I'm really expressing curiosity as much as anything else, but maybe Fred just answered the question for me. I don't want to be in the position of being the one dragging his feet or being an obstructionist or not being ready to move when the committee is ready to move. It's the biggest thing I want to do. We don't want to also place ourselves in the position of making too firm a recommendation and perhaps sidetracking the committee's ingenuity and how they structure things best for the state of Alaska. We want to be ready when you're ready.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, I want to ask one other thing. Jack, you recently had a complete reorganization. And, of course, out in the street there are many rumors concerning that reorganization. I don't think anybody really knows what's transpired there. And then number two is on 103 again. Press conference held by McMillian and the other principals no longer than 2 weeks ago in Washington, D.C., come out loud and clear again that they do not require any public financing. But I don't know, I get the idea that we're pushing for 103 again.
Well, perhaps, are you equating 103 with public financing?
Yeah, it's a subsidy of sorts, and it seems that, you're optimistic and...
I think it's...
I'm interpreting or implying maybe more than what you're saying, but it just seems that Northwest is still pushing for 103. And, at our San Francisco meeting, 103, from all practical purposes, for the participants in that arena, it's dead.
Well, I guess I do not make the same... connection you do as being, I'll agree that it's an indirect subsidy and that the taxpayers would perhaps be carrying a subsidy, but it'd be no different than many other public subsidies. We've said from the very beginning that if there was a possibility of opening up an additional $70 million potential bond market to the sale of $1 billion of revenue bonds that could be tax-free, that would be a significant benefit to the financing community. That would be another market that they otherwise are not going to be able to tap. I don't think we've ever said that was critical or crucial to the operation, that if it doesn't happen, we'll go ahead and finance in the more conventional, interest-bearing, more expensive ways. I think that the indirect subsidy would be within the concept of the President's decision and the Alaska Natural Gas Transportation Act, where they say that this is a pipeline that's in the public interest from the standpoint of balance of payments as well as benefits to the state and the lower 48. It's an all-American operation without any import, and I think that it would be well within that concept to get that indirect subsidy out of 103. It's another avenue that the doors are not closed upon. I don't think that it is, as I say, it's not a go-no-go as far as the project is concerned. You use the words complete reorganization. I assume that you're alluding to the resignation of Maury Thompson here in Anchorage.
Plus the reorganization activities that took place in Salt Lake, what kind of structural changes were made there?
I'm not aware of those. Maybe I ought to check with my boss and see if I have a job.
I don't know. These are...
I've been gone a week, so I'm not aware of any changes. We have... perhaps changed our relationship with our project management contractor somewhat, which will save us money and time in the long run.
The head office told us she'd been gone a week yesterday when we called too.
They knew. I'm glad. But no, the only changes, that organizational changes that I'm aware of, have been Maury Thompson's resignation here, right? If there are more, I'll be glad to find out for you.
Yeah,
you know.
No, I don't know. Those are the rumors on the street, and they really complicate the, you know, the activity as far as being able to offer intelligent answers as to what's happening. You know, it's best I don't know.
I think my concern is similar to Senator Collette, is that I suppose the main job of this committee at this point is to try to figure out what's going on and be informed about what's going on. So I think I was somewhat surprised when in San Francisco Senator Gravel just said point blank, the Section 103 amendment is deader than a doornail. There's no sense even talking about it. Okay, I was surprised to hear him say that. And I guess as our senator back there, and he's obviously got to be one of the people championing the cause for the amendment, for him to say that, you know, it's pretty significant. And then that just doesn't quite jive with what Northwest is saying. So, you know, I don't know where that leaves me, because I'm not back there in D.C. to know what's really going on. And even if I was, I probably wouldn't know what was going on. But, you know, there's two different things are being said here that don't jive. And so I don't know, you know, where that leaves us. And, you know, it makes a big difference, I think, to us if, regardless of whether you say, you know, that this is not critical to it or not, I think we always understood that those representatives, this is something that would help make the project go smoother. And that's part of what this committee is supposed to be doing, I guess. So it does make a difference whether Senator Gravel is right or not, you know. I don't know. And it's just kind of frustrating to hear these two different things.
Well, it's frustrating from my perspective also, because I'm not back there to where I can assess it, but I, in retrospect, was given to understand that the political climate was not right for the introduction of 103 exemption when it was introduced, and that we were not pushing it at that point in time. And we will be back in the arena, and I said in San Francisco the battle will go on in the next session.
Just a suggestion, we might try to get another some sort of an indication from the other U.S. senator as to what his opinion on that same subject might be.
Larry? Chairman, on a related question, have the committee members received copies of the answers to the questions posed by legislative research to Chairman McMillian of Northwest Conference?
No, I haven't.
You haven't them? I've got them here. I judge them responsive, and they needn't be topics of conversation right now, but you might wish to do them.
In regards to Senator Collette's questions about the subsidy and the as compared to the approval of Section 103, what would you find out for me what difference that would make in the ultimate price of gas or the transportation cost of the gas? I mean, assuming that it might not turn out to be a subsidy, it might turn out to be anti-inflationary to do it that way. I don't know how that model would come out, but I'd like to see specifically what in quantitative terms, how it might affect the price of the gas.
We'll put the computers to it. Be glad to do it.
All right. Jack, I don't think he needs the computer.
You got it, all right.
About 4 cents.
He is the computer.
Yeah.
4 cents per MCF. Four.
The 4 cent benefit, if it
the end result, one twelfth of the financing tax exempt is worth 4 cents
per MCF, of which there are 2,000 a day going down.
You better look for at least 3/4 of it that way.
That's the way I'm computing. I mean, if we do it just right, they'll pay us.
Keep thinking so. Work on that. Here in the subcommittee of what?
This committee ought to get a cut.
It's extremely high.
Whatever we can get, we get a cut up.
Yeah, we'll accept that.
Jack, do you have any other?
No, I think that's all I have, Bill. Thank you.
Any additional questions for Mr. Bachman?
I'm putting on my head.
Jack? Yeah, I have one more. Now, the reorganization that I'm hearing about is nothing more than one individual resigned, elected, not to transfer, and that's it, right?
That's the only personnel change, with exception of some additions, which I know have been hired but are not yet on board. But,
that way I can give them some straight from the horse's mouth.
I know, I'm going to hire three people.
How many of those are moving up here?
They'll all be here.
I just had a question on the federal pipeline coordinator. Why hasn't that happened yet?
That's a darn good question. I don't know.
I mean, you know, maybe is what? How significant that? I mean, the difference is it going to make is if he does get appointed, or somebody gets appointed.
Maybe Fred can answer that.
Go ahead. No, Fred.
Well, let me just tell you what little I know about it. There are two things that are going on. One is hiring the federal pipeline coordinator, and the other is the reorganization plan that has to accompany that. The reorganization plan was submitted to OMB, and I believe actually submitted to Congress, but no action taken on it. In the absence of an approved reorganization plan, it seems unlikely that anyone would take the position of federal pipeline coordinator because they don't know what their operating framework would be. And in fact, we are informed that some of the people being considered for the position have said that, and that they won't take it. After Congress didn't approve the reorganization plan, it went back. There were a fair number of problems with it. It went back to the, the EPB, Executive Policy Board. They were doing some work on it, and there was evidently some sort of slip-up between budget and OMB. And the Executive Policy Board, the thing was supposed to have been presented to Congress by the middle of November, but as a result of this slip-up, there's still work. It hasn't been approved through OMB. It should be approved, I suppose, sometime within the next month, and then it'll go to Congress for their consideration when they reconvene. And the real problem is there's been quite a bit of interplay within the federal agencies on how the reorganization should be structured. Essentially, the question is whether the authorities are going to be jerked out of the departments and put in this one pipeline agency, and everybody's going to work for the pipeline coordinator, or whether you're going to have all the authorities in the agency and the pipeline coordinator is going to administer people who work for the other agencies. And the present structure creates a strong pipeline coordinator with only one authorized agency officer from each agency in it and the rest of the people working for him. That'll go to Congress. And
is that the existing or the proposed
reorganization? That's the proposed reorganization. And this is done under the Federal Reorganization Act, where the president has the power to reorganize the executive branch subject to disapproval by Congress, although I may be wrong in that, maybe affirmative approval. In any event, that will go to Congress next year, and if Congress approves it, then they can maybe get around to hiring somebody.
So really there's nothing that can be done until Congress meets in this?
That's right, and acts, which may or may not come quickly. Now, Dingell has taken a fairly strong hand in looking at the reorganization and laying his terms down for that to be approved. And there's some sort of agreement, formal or informal, between Dingell and the people who are going to make the final approval, so that Dingell's going to have a say in whether it gets approved and how.
Jack, I think a lot of these questions are coming up, just so you know where we're coming from, especially having just returned from Canada, which we'll go into a little bit later, but they seem to be ready to roll tires down there. They've got their Northern Pipeline Agency, their one window approach set up. They've got a federal congressional standing committee or special committee set up, and we come back with any number of questions. They got their team hitched and ready to roll, and we just don't know how far our horse is out of the barn yet, and whether it's past the feeding trough and whether where. And it's just a lot of uncertainties that we have. And you probably have some too, and I appreciate that.
Jack, has Northwest looked at the reorganization? How does that impact you financially, since those are all chargeable, or are they chargebacks? for the project.
I suspect that before this project is finished, that's a question that will have to be litigated to be answered. We seem to be coming to a closer meeting of the minds with particularly the Department of Interior to what charges are under law, present law, chargeable to us, and how much of a particular charge is chargeable to us versus a portion that is for the general public good, which is properly on the on their appropriations. So far, I don't think that it's, except for the timing and the delay of the power structure here, the authority structure, I don't think it's affected us at all.
Fred, same question to you. Are we planning a charge back as we did on the LMS?
We have, that's a statutory requirement under the lease. We presently have...
is it on the gas lease?
Well, it's on any state-issued right-of-way lease, any pipeline lease that we issue for our gas pipelines. So it applies to both. By statute, we have an agreement. We have an application for a lease, and we have an agreement with Northwest whereby they are essentially paying for gas pipeline-related activities in the pipeline coordinator's office.
Anything else for Mr. Bachman?
Can I just ask, is there a new official revised cost estimate for the entire project?
There will be one, but I've not seen it yet. It's supposed to come in December, from particularly from Florida. They've been working on it.
I've seen some printed in some papers. It said $14 billion, but that's not official, I suppose.
I think the $14 billion, you have to be careful with the next sentence after that. I think that probably is in terms of cost in actual dollars expended over the life of the project and not directly comparable with the $10 billion estimate in terms of $75.
But do you expect a new estimate in December?
Yes.
Anything else, Jack?
Anything might have something when I hear the rest of this.
Okay. Thanks very much, Jack. Appreciate the candid responses. Arlen Cutting is next up.
Is that three over here?
Yeah.
Arlen, before you begin, I think I should ask Randall to distribute some of those copies of the report. That bomb-shaped package, I
will.
Bomb-shaped. I'll distribute it. Why don't you begin now, distribute it, and build this thing up.
Does anyone have a knife or person?
Just
did members of the committee get a copy of this report?
No.
We've had a problem then with the mails. Remember they were sent. I have just enough copies for the committee.
They were sent, Chris?
Well, yes. Yes, they must have been sent, so much earlier this week.
Perhaps Jack Tessin can give us a summary version of
his worst fear of having
a raw audience.
Well, I'm not going to waste your time by summarizing or by going into detail on something you can read and... I will touch on the highlights. As you know, the Institute of Social and Economic Research at the University has a contract to look at the economics of the gas pipeline project and to come up with some kind of judgment as to what kind of financial participation in the project might be prudent for the state from an economic point of view. Also, I'm sure that you know the principal workers on this are myself and Connie Barlow. We have some assistance from Norm Chappell, who was formerly the Minister Counselor for Energy at the Canadian Embassy in Washington, and from other members of the Institute. Our approach is essentially a triad kind of approach. You know the rule of medics on a battlefield is they go and tag the wounded to classify them into three groups. There are those who will survive even if they don't get immediate attention, and there are those who are going to die even if you take care of them. And so the ones you worry about, the ones you evacuate first and send the medic to first, are those for whom the immediate attention is going to make a difference. And so what our our ultimate objective is to make a judgment as to whether this pipeline is viable, regardless of whether the state gets involved. If if the pipeline, if given the economic and political realities in the lower 48 and in Canada, the pipeline has a very substantial chance of proceeding without state financial involvement, and you may judge that it's not a good thing for the state to get involved in, just in terms of dispersion of risk, in terms of portfolio management. It doesn't make much sense to take money or a financial position the state has generated out of the Prudhoe Field and sink it into something else that's whose success is contingent on income from Prudhoe, where if there's a collapse of world energy markets, if they're producing problems in the field, you've lost your money twice. On the other hand, if it looks as if the obstacles to putting this project together are insuperable, regardless of what the state does, then the state, the administration, the legislature are going to have to take a hard look at what alternatives are to the pipeline. What is going to be done with the gas? How is the reservoir going to be managed if the gas is unsaleable? And our problem focuses on the third alternative, that is if state financial involvement is likely to have a significant effect on the prospects of the pipeline, what are the costs and risks of state involvement? How much state involvement is likely to be necessary? And then it's up to you to decide whether the benefits of having the pipeline justify the risks and costs that the state take on. We're doing this in a rather systematic way, and it's sometimes tempting to try to telegraph, to give you a notion of where we think the eventual answer is going to end up. I think I'm going to try to avoid coming to any premature conclusions. I will say, however, that it's very likely the state is going to have to make some very hard early decisions that the pipeline project may very well be a precarious one, in which if the state asks for too much in terms of a wellhead price, even the ceiling price provided by the energy bill, in terms of local hire, in terms of local development spinoffs, the state could very well kill. I think that's something that one's got to consider in looking at whether the pipeline is in the interest of the state. But anyway, we have produced a first preliminary report, and there are two parts to it. The first part is an introduction to the gas industry, an attempt to explain in plain English what the terms being bandied about mean, what natural gas is, what its relation to crude oil and natural gas liquids is, how gas is sold and marketed, how the producers, the transmission companies, the local distributors are regulated, how a gas project is financed, and bringing all of these into specific reference to the proposed Alaska Highway Gas Pipeline. We felt this was essential because when we first got into trying to understand this, discovered that there is no textbook, plain English or any other kind of English, where one can go and find out how the industry operates and how the Federal Power Commission, Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, and the state commissions interact. What the financial structure of the industry is. And so the first half of this report is a simple and direct an exposition of what the system is all about and how it works as we can come up with. The second part deals with the marketing and financing question for high-cost gas supplements in general. This is a revised edition of a report that Connie and I did for the Office of Oil and Gas of the U.S. Department of Energy last summer. trying to assess whether any of the capital-intensive, high-cost gas supplements, that is imported LNG, synthetic gas from oil or coal, and Alaska natural gas, can find a home in the U.S. energy market in the 80s and 90s, and whether they can be financed, or whether in view of uncertainties that may exist about their marketability, whether they can in fact be financed. And we proceed through this question systematically. There are some rather technical parts of this chapter, although I think the report is written in a way that anybody here can follow it and understand all of it. There are a couple chapters in the middle of that that may be a little tedious if you don't like quantitative economic exposition. You can run through and read only the stuff in italics and pretty well come up with the general conclusion, the general line of reason. There are a number of elements here which are novel, and some which may have been novel 6 months ago but aren't novel today. One of the things that we discovered is that despite the conviction of the energy industry, the media, and the regulators that gas is a premium fuel, that the market, the energy market, regards it as an inferior fuel, and that gas will not sell for a higher price than other fuels. Since we discovered this empirically, we discovered this as a fact of the world, and then went around, then tried to explain it to ourselves.
When you say inferior fuel, are you relating strictly to price?
I'm saying that...
Is that an economic?
That's an economic. See, when people say it's premium fuel, they're saying that people will pay a higher price per million BTU for gas than they will for oil or whatever. And we found that every place that you could show that people had a choice, they would pay a lower price for gas than for alternatives. People will pay for home heating, they will pay twice the price for electricity that they will pay for gas, for example. In the residential sector, in the commercial and industrial sector, you price gas out of the market at something in the order of 75% to 80% of the price of whatever fuel oil that particular sector uses. That is, with respect to home heating, it's the price of number two fuel oil, that is light distillate fuel oil delivered at retail from the tank wagon. With respect to electric utilities or large industrial consumers, it's the bulk price of whatever number six oil, whatever residual oil is acceptable in the air quality conditions in the particular area. I don't want to dwell on this, and we didn't dwell on it as much as we might have. We never came out and said that gas is an inferior fuel. We just talked about what determines people's the demand for gas. But at this proposition, or this hypothesis or finding, fits in with a number of other assumptions that are held by the gas industry and by energy planners and regulators that are crucial to deciding whether something like the Alaska Highway Gas Pipeline is a viable project. There's a number of assumptions behind a project like this. The most crucial, and held both by industry and by government, is the notion that the age of cheap energy is over. That alternative fuels are going to be scarcer and harder to come by in the future. And by the future, I mean the late 1980s, in the 1990s. That is the proposed economic life of this project than they are today. And this is certainly the official stance of the federal government, and it is what people have accepted. It's been the general consensus since the Arab oil embargo and the OPEC price revolution in 1973-1974. The problem is that this is by no means a universal consensus. I would almost go as far to say that only the CIA, Exxon, and Secretary Schlesinger really believe him. That is, that since 1975, the real world price of oil has been going down very rapidly, and that we are moving into a period of a buyer's market in energy, both in oil and gas. That there are continental surpluses developing, both of oil and gas, and that these can be regarded as short term or long term. And I think there's no hard and fast way of determining it. It comes on faith. It depends on your worldview whether you think that these are long-term or short-term surpluses. But 2 or 3 years of oil and gas surpluses will go a long way into turning around the impressions or the theories people developed about the long-term on the basis of the oil embargo. That is, in 1973-74, you had a sharp reduction in oil supplies worldwide coming on right at the time that our own Texas and Louisiana production peaked out. Prices in the world market quadrupled in a matter of months. And this gave credence to all sorts of doomsday theories of the world oil and gas reserves. These are theories that were sort of self-serving theories held by the energy industry, saying we need higher prices, we need subsidies, we need all sorts of protection. And theories also held by environmentalists who said we've got to get off this fossil fuel kick, the world's going to run out, there's going to be nothing for our descendants. And so these theories became almost universally accepted. The crunch doesn't look as imminent as it did a couple years ago. And what's important here is that this will have this change in perception is going to have a very strong influence on what the gas company and the willingness of the gas companies in the lower 48 to sign long-term cost of service contracts for an energy supply which is going to cost them substantially more than alternative fuels cost today. On the willingness of the institutional lenders, the insurance companies, pension funds, and so on, to invest in these projects, state utility commissions to approve these long-term contracts, and Congress ultimately to provide whatever backstopping is necessary to underwrite these projects. We go ahead and say, well, we're not going to quarrel about the long-term outlook. Let's accept for the sake of argument the notion that the United States needs to invest in high-cost energy resources as insurance against the possibility that oil will be increasingly scarce and costly, and that other supplies of gas can't fill the gap. Let's suppose that. What are the policies that flow from that? And we find that we conclude tentatively that if the pre-completion risks, the problem of regulatory instability, and those can be overcome, that the gas from Alaska would be marketable, or that FERC could make this project go if it had the political will. If it really believed, for instance, if the federal administration and the commission really believed their own the world will face a buyer's market in energy at least for the next 3-5 years, maybe to the turn of the century. And the strategies, economic policies, projects that depend on the assumption that there is a seller's market that very high cost forms of energy, including, say, new resources in Arctic Alaska, are going to be needed and are going to be accepted by the market, may have to be reevaluated. I think again, not to anticipate too much start conclusions, that it's very possible that this pipeline has to be really put together in the next few months. The essential commitments have to be made, or it's not a matter of a delay of a year or a construction season, but an indefinite delay for a resource which may not, in fact, be an economic resource, and the state may have to look at alternatives.
Let me interrupt for just a second so I'm real clear on one point. I think we're all aware that there's a possibility of plenty of gas in the next couple of years, but did you say that this buyer's market may be in effect until the turn of the century?
Yes, we know that there's going to be more oil and gas coming on stream in North America. It's going to be coming on stream faster than demand's going to be growing for the next 4 or 5 years. It is entirely conceivable that it's maybe an accelerating process of supply adequacy. That the OPEC price revolution has had the effects that conventional Economics 101 would predict. That is, that that supplies increase, that an enormous increase in price leads to an enormous increase in supplies. Now, so far, a lot of this is very speculative. For example, the Canadian Deep Basin. There is John Masters and Canadian Hunter have a hypothesis about the formation in which they've been drilling in western Alberta, and it extends into British Columbia, that there is a single enormous gas field 175 miles long and at some places 10,000 feet thick that may have as much as 400 to 500 TCF of ultimate containment. Now this is a hypothesis, and there are geologists are increasingly coming toward a hypothesis that the Arctic belt from the Beaufort Sea all the way over to the Chukchi Sea may well be a huge gas province, that you're looking at 100 TCF in the Canadian Beaufort, maybe 100 TCF in NPRA. And whether a transportation system can be developed to make those marketable is something else. It is now beginning to become a question whether the same price incentives which led to tremendous reserve additions in Alberta over the last 3 years aren't beginning to have the same effect in the overthrust belt, the Rocky Mountain area in the United States, and whether it hasn't made economic some entirely new kinds of gas resources like the very deep gas in the Anadarko. But we have the problem with the Mexican development, and this is an interesting one that the CIA and Secretary Schlesinger have been aware of the Mexican developments for at least 3 years. And the federal administration, for the purpose of pushing through its policy, has systematically ignored, concealed but it looks again, and the answers aren't all in. It looks as if Mexico is in fact a larger potential oil producer than Saudi Arabia. That Mexico and the Caribbean may be comparable to the entire Persian Gulf. And Mexico is flaring gas now. If, as is possible, as is quite conceivable, they're producing 5 million barrels a day in 1985 and 10 million in 1990, there's going to be as much associated gas coming off of those fields than could conceivably be absorbed by the increase in both the U.S., Mexican, and U.S. markets combined.
Yeah, but on this gas, that, let's say that you just mentioned the possible 100 TCF in the Canadian Beaufort or the Deep Basin, doesn't everybody, isn't it generally accepted that this is unrecoverable under current economics?
Well, what do you mean by current economics? You mean a 75-cent net back at the well, which is what they're getting now. And I didn't hear the presentation from John Masters, but I saw his AAPG presentation, and he's talking of 50 to 100 TCF being recovered at a wellhead price of $1.75, which they see as way above current levels. Well, $1.75 in Alberta is one hell of a lot cheaper than $1.63 plus conditioning plus transportation at the North Slope. And so the Mexicans' proposed price of $2.60 was probably too high for the amount of gas they're talking about, and to this extent the Department of Energy had a point. But $2.60 in 1980 or 81, given current rates of inflation, is not so outrageous. And again, it's a hell of a lot cheaper than the prices anybody's talking about getting either Alaskan or Canadian Arctic gas to market.
Sounds like you put a lot of credibility into the, you know, Massey's, even his low figures of 50 to 100. I mean, 440 is a pretty far out, but even yeah. 100 trillion is.
Well, that's four Prudhoe Bays, and.
But who? I'm asking you as far as, you know, part of your whole presentation here. I mean, how much credibility are you actually giving?
Well,
to those kind of figures?
You don't have to put credibility on any one of them. There are two points. First, that the availability of conventional energy in North America was tremendously underestimated, systematically underestimated, and deliberately and self-servingly underestimated, I would say, by the major energy producers and the federal administration over the last few years. Now, whatever, you can throw out two out of three of these new things and say, well, that's just myth, that's speculation. But the fact is that we do have oil and gas coming out of in large quantities available in from areas that weren't even counted. The Canadian National Energy Board in 1976 and the Ministry of Energy, Mines and Resources, both in 75 and 76, did studies, projections of Canadian energy requirements and demand. And both the NEB and EMR listed the supply categories, potential supply categories, as proved reserves in the Western Basin, as Alberta, Saskatchewan, and British Columbia. With respect to oil, they said enhanced recovery in the Western Basin. And they had frontier, both oil and gas, and oil sands, tar sands. These were the categories. There wasn't even a category there, new discoveries in the Western Basin, either for oil and gas. The big oil companies, say Imperial Oil, and the official Canadian government position was that Alberta had been drilled out. There was really nothing more to. There were no significant discoveries to be made. Well, you, Deep Basin or not, you've got. They've been adding 4, 5, 6, 7 TCF a year of conventional reserves in Alberta. They talk about it as a bubble. I don't think that anybody, except for the government on both sides, anybody talks about it as a bubble anymore. There is a growing surplus of gas in Alberta, and you don't need to include Deep Basin. Mexico is not a myth. You can speculate as to whether there are 100 TCF of reserves or a quadrillion cubic feet or whatever. It makes similar speculations about oil, but there's no question that Mexico is far bigger than anything than had been expected from conventional resources in all of North America from now to the end of time, two, three years ago. Well, that's one point, that there is a lot more energy in North America, conventional energy, available at costs considerably less than the cost of importing LNG, of making gas from coal, or bringing Arctic gas by pipeline. They're bringing gas by pipeline from Arctic, Alaska, or Canada.
But it's going to be at a substantially higher price than we've done that.
Well, price and cost is something else. Cost is what really determines whether it's viable. Mexico and Canada, the oil companies, whoever, are going to price whatever there is at all the traffic will bear. The question is, what will the traffic bear? Now, because of the growth of energy demand in the United States, because Saudi Arabia is reluctant to increase its production beyond 10 million barrels a day because of political turmoil in Iran and so on, if because of these things, the real price of oil, the price of oil in the world as adjusted for inflation, doubles between now and 1985, as Deputy Secretary O'Leary has predicted, and as Exxon predicted only a year ago, then what will the traffic bear? The traffic will bear all the gas that can be brought from the North American Arctic by pipeline at the expected real costs of that pipeline. If on the other hand, the OPEC oil price averages 3% a year in nominal dollars and goes down 5% a year in real terms, and there's a lot of gas around that the Canadians and Mexicans are willing to sell at roughly the world oil price, then the U.S. market will not accept Alaska gas without a political subsidy, without a subsidy that more than simply the authority to roll in the price. Because this rolled-in pricing is very valuable if somebody wants to sell expensive gas right now. How much it's going to be worth in 1990 with the old cheap, with the 50-cent gas virtually having disappeared, and with deregulation of conventional supplies, and with a large component of Canadian and Mexican gas brought in at the commodity value price, the price will, what does that rolled-in pricing mean in 1990? So this gas has got, in the long term, regardless of what rule Congress or FERC sets, this gas has got to meet an incremental price test in the long term. And the pipeline will not work unless the gas over its full life can meet an incremental price test. And a gas distributor, an interstate gas pipeline in the lower 48, will not sign a contract to buy the gas and move it through that pipeline unless they believe they would be able to market it on an incremental price basis in 1990. And that is unless there's certain political steps taken, unless there's an explicit federal subsidy. One of the things we suggest here, if the federal government wants this pipeline, they need to front end load the tariff very heavily. There's a big cushion of low cost gas that can be rolled in with now. So let gas consumers would be willing to pay a higher price, or residential consumers would be willing to pay a higher price now before shifting to other fuels. And so in a sense, the pipeline, with the proper tariff treatment, the cost of the pipeline could be prepaid to a large extent by tilting the tariffs very much toward the present and letting the pipeline just collect operating costs and the cost of the gas in the far future. Now, whether they want to adopt that, whether FERC could adopt it in the face of opposition from state utility commissions, from consumer advocate groups, and so on, something else.
Jack, wasn't that, that was attempted, wasn't it?
It was proposed. I don't know. It was never seriously considered.
I'm sorry, I didn't get the subject. What was attempted?
The front end load.
The front end
load. The tariff.
I don't think so.
No, this has never came out of the conversation stage that I'm on.
It seems like an attempt to do, Mr. Chair, an attempt to do that would be to acknowledge essentially worldwide that there is the oncoming surpluses or of product, and simply continue to buy from Canada or someplace where there's, you know, to cover this short span of time. Because you're saying if we got a market at all, it's going to look at our fields, it's got to occur in the not too distant future.
The problem is nobody knows. You're investing in a facility with a, say, a 20-year or greater economic life, which doesn't go on stream for 5 to 7 years. It is a perfectly valid approach to say that this project probably could not make it its own in the private market. The uncertainties are too great, but precisely because of these uncertainties, the nation has to choose these things that we can't afford. If these new supplies don't materialize, if the Middle East blows up, so on, we can't afford not to have these potential domestic resources. And so it's quite legit. It's a quite legitimate line of argument to say that because of these uncertainties, the federal government should take those actions to make this thing financeable now. So even if it turns out, there's a chance it turns out to be a white elephant. We sink the cost now. We are paying. If you buy insurance, you buy life insurance and you live to 90, you buy term insurance anyway, you've thrown away your money. You buy automobile insurance and you don't have a wreck, you've thrown away your money. But that may be a prudent gamble in view of the alternatives. And so you could say, get from the point of view of the administration, from the point of view of national economic efficiency, gas is underpriced today because it is so much cheaper than other fuels. Because people can get gas for a dollar and it's really worth two and a half, if they tend to waste it. So you're not really doing the nation any harm in terms of the gas economy to raise the price by now and use some of that higher price to pre-finance some insurance against the national economic disaster in the future. Now, whether that's a respectable line of argument, that's a valid, whether it's the right one depends on what you really believe the dangers are and what the costs are. And if it's just a remote contingency that there's going to be a serious energy shortage in the mid to late 1980s, then maybe you don't want to pay a large premium to insure yourself against a very small contingency of loss.
Well, that's a number of personal, subjective options you've given us. What do you think? That's what we're paying you for.
I don't think there's going to be a crunch. I don't know, because you can't predict whether the blow up in the Middle East. You can't. On the other hand, you can't predict all the surprises that can come from the other side. It might feel, and I've said this for at least 5 years, is that from a strict economic point of view, natural gas in the North Slope of Alaska delivered either by any of the three proposed systems was not an economic proposition. I think you remember the editorials in the Times denouncing me for saying that the wellhead value might be zero or negative. That is, if you subtracted the transportation cost from the real value in the market, that the gas might be worth approximately nothing, or less,
or double.
Arlen, you've been, or you have never been hesitant to venture political opinion, and that's what this is reduced to. If it has no economics, then it has to be political. What's political karma? Do they make that decision?
Well, I think. at the present time, the political climate is eroded. And this is why I disagreed with the with Northwest on the and with the federal administration on the significance of the president's energy bill. That now that the Congress has set some of the ground rules, only now can the commission begin to flesh them out with detailed rules. And the, there seem to be both the pipeline sponsors and the federal administration seem to think that as soon as Congress passed this legislation, you would get bargaining in earnest between the producers and potential gas purchasers. The thing is, they don't know anything more about the pricing than they did 2 years ago. If, on the other hand, at the time the president had made his right in September 1977, the Federal Power Commission gone ahead with a, if the president had proposed an expedited rulemaking process, whereby the Federal Power Commission could start, then we would have been would be a year and a half ahead of the game with respect to determining the ultimate pricing rule. And or if they'd accepted the proposal of the New York State Public Service Commission, or even the federal to deregulate the thing, I would say there are no windfall profits that are going to be made on this pipeline or on North Slope gas by decontrolling it. And say the New York State Public Service Commission, under Alfred Kahn, who's now the president's inflation fighter, said if just let it be negotiated between the transmission companies, their financiers, the state of Alaska, and the oil companies, and if they can put it together in some way that they can get that gas downstream and at a price the market will accept, let them go. If they can't, without any economic constraints on them, do it, then it probably isn't worth doing. The Federal Power Commission wasn't willing to go that far. They wanted cost of service on the pipeline. They said, well, let's just set the... let's deregulate the wellhead price, conditioning costs, and those things. Let's just set a price at the Chicago City Gate that takes into account what we think this gas is going to be worth to the nation, and let them try to work it out. Well, if they'd done that, and if the president had proposed that in 77 and Congress had accepted it, we would be a long way down the road. Now, there are two things that the energy bill has done. It's the latest to the point that the whole perception of the energy problem has changed, and it's held out to the state and the producers an utterly unrealistic price. That we all would have been tickled to get 75 cents, 75 cents plus inflation, if they hadn't wanted to tie it to the higher price for so-called old gas in the lower 48. And the $1.63 plus inflation, plus or minus conditioning costs, may well be what breaks the back. Look at the position the legislature's put in now. Congress has said $1.63 plus inflation. And can you politically agree to say a 75 cent or 65 cent price now, even if the producers were willing to do it? Could you go back to your districts having agreed on a package that produced that for the sake of, or how long would it take before you can accept that? I get the reading from at least one of the producers that they're going to hold out hell or high water for what Congress has offered them, even if it's too high. And so this is another thing it's introduced a kind of unrealistic political factor into it. The Congress has said this is going to be rolled in, and we've sort of made a commitment to make it marketable, even if it's uneconomic.
Mr. Chairman, let me just interrupt. I'm really sort of back to asking a direct question in terms of all the things that you know today and all the variables that you've recited. How much longer do you? How much more time is there before all this puzzle has to be put together to build a pipeline? Or, on the basis of what you were saying to us earlier this morning, that it's not going to happen on the basis of world supply? What would you guess is that period of time?
I don't know, and it's one of the. I'd like to approach that systematically and not
Well, I thought you had.
But we're not through with the project. We have three more preliminary reports and a final report. And
what is your best guess then at this time?
During the next legislative session.
I think you may well
be faced with the decision of making this thing go or kill it. I don't know.
In this coming session. So that we can't abandon...
The sponsors are perfectly right. They cannot, for their own reasons, come and say this thing is precarious, it may fall apart at any moment. We have to have this and this and this or else it won't go. But it may well come to that, and the state, their emphasis, a perfectly legitimate, correct one, is on maintaining the momentum, on maintaining the everybody's conviction that this is a viable project, that things are happening step by step. If you have 6 months or a year or something like that in which nothing happens, this erosion I talked about can be fatal.
Okay. And
it may well be that they'll be up to the state, that the federal pipeline coordinator hasn't been appointed, there haven't been any sale contracts, there haven't been any transportation contracts, there are no firm financing commitments from the banks and so on. And the state may just have to make the next move and next series of moves and dramatic ones to keep this project alive.
Okay, and would you guess that the probability that if it isn't put together in the next 15 to 18 months, for instance, or 2 years, that there's a high probability that it's fatal to the project?
In its present form, yes. I think there's a high probability. I say there are a lot of things we don't
know.
Understand,
but your best guess
is
that it'd be fatal if it goes
that
long.
And it's also a moving target, because you look at all the things that have happened in the last 6 months that I could have had a hunch a year ago that our problem is going to be a gas surplus, not a gas shortage. But you really couldn't point this and that. So that between now and March, when we're supposed to have a final report, all sorts of things may happen, and I don't want to get pinned into a conclusion about what I'm going to say to the committee or to the legislature in March, when we've still got a lot of work to do.
No, but let me ask you on a comment that I recall. We were virtually alone in the state of the roof. The gas line was going to take. And at that time, you emphasized very strongly that the international aspects between the U.S. and Canada would be determined by that. How's that changed today? Or has it changed because of the Canadian fines?
Well, it could be changing depending on the Canadian fines. There are several parts of the question. There is the gas there in Canada? Is it going to be developed? Are the Canadians going to allow the export? See, the Canadian federal government is locked into the same kind of national energy independence myth the United States government is. That Trudeau has been saying the same kind of thing about Canada that Carter's been saying about the United States. And the Canadian national energy policy, since even before the embargo, has been aimed at self-sufficiency, and the Trudeau administration, the Trudeau government, has been saying we can't afford, we've got to cut off the exports to the Americans, we've got to build West pipelines in Canada, there's going to be a big crunch. And he's had other reasons for it. For example, that the east-west linkages are important to tie Quebec into the Union. They were going to cut off the Americans, they build the Sarnia-Montreal pipeline so that they can use Canadian oil in Quebec refineries. Well, that's an uneconomic decision. It may have made sense from a Canadian national security point of view if you thought there was going to be a world oil crisis. It doesn't make economic sense now, but it makes a tremendous amount of political sense if you want to emphasize the unity of Quebec with the rest of Canada. So there's a big political push to send the surplus gas to subsidize its being sent to Quebec City and Halifax and so on to to cement together Canadian unity. Now, there's a... I probably don't know as much of the Canadian political and administration situation as those members who went to Canada last week. But there are wild cards there. You can't count... You just can't count 100% on that gas being available to the United States, even if it is physically present. I would bet that it would be available, that they've got their own balance of payments problems, they've got the pressure from the western provinces, they've got all sorts of other reasons, the abundance of Canadian gas works two ways. It's a two-edged sword. It facilitates this project to the extent that it allows pre-building. It facilitates it to the extent that it fills up the Canadian partner companies with cash and with credibility and with self-confidence. Again, my feeling is that as far as the construction of this project in Canada is concerned, there's no problem. I think the Canadian companies will come in under budget, or pretty close to budget, as they usually do. I don't see why Northwest Alaskan shouldn't come in under budget. I think they started with inflated construction. They used Alyeska productivity figures, which are worst case estimate, and this whole business of anticipating 40% overruns beyond inflation is maybe unrealistic. But anyway, the Canadian side should, as I see it now, and I haven't studied all the problems, and the next couple weeks, Connie and I and Norm Chappell are going to be working on this. That the problems are at the two ends. The problems are in the field with respect to conditioning. How's the reservoir going to function? Should the gas cap be produced? What is the conservation board going to do about these? There are a whole series of problems at that end. And the other is, are the markets there? And if you answer those problems, if the gas is producible, and if the markets are there at the price, certainly the Canadian part ought to fall into place. The other gap is the U.S. regulatory situation. Have we got such a complicated legal and regulatory situation in the United States that even if the economics are there, even if the gas is there, you can't get from here to there. You just can't put it together. There's a vicious circle of chicken and egg sort of situation. And that is also something we're looking at. The next thing that Connie and I are going to be working on is try to put together a critical path map of this project. All the things that have to be done from a political, regulatory, financing, engineering standpoint, and the sequence in which they have to be done to see whether it is possible to get from here to there. And I'm not sure. I don't want to prejudge that, but there are the legal and regulatory situation. It imposes a lot of obstacles. After all this bad news, let me throw in something that really doesn't have anything directly to do with the gas pipeline. But I think from the states. A long-term energy outlook. Things are looking pretty good. I think I'm very optimistic about an export authorization for the oil within the foreseeable future. And on the other hand, we need it because the gas may be unmarketable and the price of oil may be. Right now, the Mexicans may well back all our oil out of the Gulf, out of the U.S. Gulf.
Alaska exports.
Yeah.
That's good news.
No, I say that we need it. The good news is we may be able to export it.
Is that market necessarily there in Japan, though? I mean, do we automatically assume that whatever we want to sell to Japan or whatever we might want to export from Prudhoe to Japan?
Well, in the volumes, we're talking a couple hundred thousand barrels a day, no question.
A couple million
probably. Now, we're talking about, we're going to be we may be competing with Mexico and Japan, and this is one of the objectives which Bob Loresh and I are trying to talk to the Mexicans there. They are planning to build an east-to-west pipeline, build a super port on the west coast of Mexico for the purpose of marketing their oil in Japan and on the west coast of the United States. And it doesn't seem to make much sense for there to be a thrust to build super ports on the west coast of the United States and new pipelines across the United States, or to take the oil through the Panama Canal to serve the U.S. Gulf and the east coast.
So the good
news, while the Mexicans are selling in Japan, and that becomes so obvious and gives so much just rationality to the whole swap.
Are you saying the best news we can expect is that we'll get export authority at the time there's little or no export market?
No, I think the problem is that there is a significant possibility that the world oil prices will continue to erode, particularly in real terms. We may get backed out of the Gulf, but at the same time, we may have a new market opened up at $1 to $2 higher than the U.S. Gulf, and that may postpone doomsday. I mean, it may make Lisburn and Kupar, it would make pipeline expansion economic. It might make Lisburn and Kupar and Point Thompson economic, and certainly give a push to exploration, which will come to a standstill with the kind of netbacks that can be anticipated without it.
I guess I just don't understand economic good news.
As an oil state, we better become fishermen.
Yeah, I think the good news is looking up from the point of view.
Other questions for Dr. Tessing?
Are we there asking for the final report?
Hell no.
Let me ask a question. One of the things I wanted to be here for, I didn't need to go through all of this, you could read it, is that I'd like to get some guidance from the committee on the issues that you'd like us to take up between now and the final report. And the sequence, our contract provides lists the names of certain preliminary reports we've got to do. But that's changeable, and Greg is very flexible about that. And we'd like to be responsive to the questions that are foremost in your minds and the questions you'd like to have resolved at an early time.
You say you got a list of projects you're already planning on doing in here?
Yeah.
On the contract.
Yeah, it's in the contract. It's mentioned here.
Okay,
say
fine.
On the Roman 5, other reports planned for 1978 to 1979 include description and analysis of project financing techniques, particularly as they apply to the Alaskan gas line. Attempt to foresee what will really happen as a result of the Natural Gas Policy Act 1978. A critical path analysis of the Alaska gas line. An assessment of Canadian gas industry developments and policies, and our final report. But I think the Canadian report is going to be done in-house by Legislative Affairs. Actually, we will just touch on. We'll incorporate the Canadian part of our report into the critical path analysis. And I understand that Larry Uffenbach is going to do a report on Canada.
Mr. Chairman, in keeping with his request, one of the things that I'm concerned about, and I hope the rest of you are, is that time period that exists, or what time period, maximum time period exists, before this project is just not going to happen. And the likelihood of meeting all the necessary criteria to put that together in that time frame. And that boils down to a simple question: is on a scale of 1 to 10, what the hell is the future of this project?
That, in a sense, is the final.
But, won't you cover part of that?
Critical
path,
yes.
Yeah. And when do you plan on having that from the barrel?
Well, I look at it now, say, in draft, maybe about the, around Christmas. So before the first of the year. You got to have it ought to have it before the legislature convenes at the latest.
But then the summary of additional reports is not necessarily the sequence.
No, and that can be changed. If there are other things you want a special report on, our quickie.
I don't have any specific questions right now, but a number of us are going to be getting together over the next week, and maybe we'll give you a agenda in a week or so,
Mr. Chairman,
say I might want this or this. You would take a special day.
Yeah, there are a couple things that I would be interested in just suggesting. One is your assessment of who the players are in terms of the total industry, whether it's the bankers or the distribution companies or the transmission companies, who will be most significant in making the decisions that are in some fashion responsive to the kinds of analysis you're presenting and how they will perceive that analysis. For example, a great deal hinges on whether you're simply optimistic or pessimistic, as you've indicated, with respect to the future, how they will integrate the kinds of your analysis and your report into their decision-making process and respond to that with respect to all the other world developments. Then I think that would be a useful kind of thing if you can address that. And another thing that would be, I think, interesting is to make the assumption that you're right in terms of an optimistic view, but make the further assumption that other people haven't take the pessimistic view, or the federal government pushes for it, what have you. Contracts are entered into between transmission companies and the producers at the ceiling price. The pipeline is built, and gas is ready to flow, and all this other gas is available, be it geopressurized brine, be it the overthrust belt, be it Mexican gas, be it Canadian gas, and all of those can, in fact, be delivered.
Well, I think
at
I can answer
prices,
that one.
Right below no, that, and to look at the different kinds of responses available to the decision makers at that point to implement the system, not only the decision makers, but also the producers and the owners of the pipeline. I mean, is all hell going to break loose at that point? Is the federal government just going to deny export licenses, even though that may be an economically irrational decision? Sort of explore the options there.
Okay. I think the answer to that question part is in this. What happened that essentially the marketing decision is going to be made before construction takes place. That there is no marketing problem for the project itself if they get these long-term contracts. The question is, what happens to the people who have signed the long-term contracts, or even more, what has happened to the gas distributors who are required to take this gas under their existing service agreements and don't have any choice as to how much of it to take? And we say, you know, what is the federal response to gas distributors going broke is another thing. The federal response so far is to a lot of these things is perverse. The National Energy Act is going to cause an increase in oil imports in this thing, because it is based on the assumption that gas is a premium fuel that is the scarcest fossil fuel and ought to be conserved at all costs. And so the so-called incremental pricing scheme is what this does. I wouldn't call it incremental pricing, but what it does is make